Hi, everyone. My name is David Palmer. I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic. I haven't heard from Chris, so I'm assuming he's going to show up in a little bit. But Mike has so nicely offered to sit in for him, which Mike just found out about right now, actually, until he shows up.
So our second speaker is Mike Finley.
And there you go. Always of service, right?
Yeah.
So we're on the family afterward, all right? So I'm going to start reading. So if you have the regular big book, you're going to see me say some stuff that isn't exactly in there, only because the family afterward from the original manuscript is a little bit different than the family afterward in the big book. If you have one of the maroon books, it'll be the same. You all ready?
Page 56.
Yes, thank you. So, chapter 9, the family afterward. Our women folk have suggested certain attitudes a wife may take with the husband who is recovering. Perhaps they created the impression that he is to be wrapped in cotton wool and placed on a pedestal. Successful readjustment means the opposite. All members of the family must meet upon the common ground of tolerance, understanding, and love. This involves a process of deflation. The alcoholic, his wife, his children, his in-laws, each one is likely to have fixed ideas about the family's attitude toward himself or herself. Each is interested in having his or her wishes respected. The more one member of a family demands that the other concede to him, the more resentful they become. This makes for discord and unhappiness. You know, I love the fact that Bill constantly goes back to this idea of commonality. You know, we find it in the common peril, the common problem, the common manifestation of the peril and the problem, right? As well as the common solution that we all enjoy, which is the idea of getting with God. But here's another example of common ground, right? Just because I got sober, things in the household didn't get better, right? And in fact, in a lot of ways, things in the household got worse. Now, granted, the police had stopped coming to the door and knocking it down, right? The mob wasn't coming anymore. The Colombians weren't stopping by. So those things had gotten better, right? But what had happened, right? When I'm introduced to a spiritual process and I'm put into this room, I'm left with me, right? I'm not drinking anymore. Just me left. And me is a very uncomfortable place, or else I would never have drank that much, right? If me was comfortable. If me was comfortable, I would be like the non-alcoholic, just bitter for other reasons, right? But in my case, you know, remove the alcohol, and there's that wonderful period. Remember when everything just feels better, like when your kidneys start to work again, and you're not as physically run down, and I was on that kind of pink cloud for a while, you know, and I was coming home and I was being helpful and I was being nice. Until one day, they didn't treat me right. Right? They didn't treat me right. Mm. And I came home and started taking... I was living with my mom, like any good, you know, major drug dealer will, you know. And started to take it out on her. Now, she doesn't have any repair structures in place. She doesn't know how to deal with a sober Dave. She hasn't seen a sober Dave in 9 years. Right? So the problems that happened right off the bat weren't the ones of the old days, but they're the new days, right? The dysfunctionality, right? The problems that all the machinations and the carvings that and the cogs and everything else that worked so well with a massive lie of my alcoholism no longer worked with the reality of the day, right? And there was conflict. There was conflict. You know, I thought she needed to change things. She thought I needed to shut up. You know, and there was this whole kind of idea, but if about what should actually happen. Now, this could have been my wife when I came back in 2004 and rolled into the house. You know, I wanted things to be better. And the funny thing was, less than a year back, I realized that the major problem in my household was my mouth. Mm-hmm. You know, that's when I got to the 10th step with my sponsor, and I started taking a long, hard look at what was going on. You know, I'd come home from work, and I'd be upset because I had worked really hard for the family. I had created wealth for the family. I had done all the responsible things I was supposed to do. Then I walked through the door, and how dare she want to tell me about her day? You know, I don't want to hear about your day. You know, I don't want to care about your day, right? So I learned, though, that keeping my mouth shut made sense. And the funny thing was, it actually started at work. Because I used to get into these arguments with people at work, and I would go home. I mean, back into recovery in 04, and I'd go home at night and go, "Oh shit, I got to make an amends to Bob." You know, Bob, who was the cancer survivor, who I said, "I'm going to buy you a carton of cigarettes if you don't shut up." You know, that's the kind of stuff that I would say at work. You know, because I was a very aggressive asshole. And you know, I go back the next day and make an amends to Bob and have a conversation with him. Really, you know, and not repeat the behavior, right? Because that's the imperative, right? The amends is supposed to be about not repeating the behavior. And then I get in an argument with somebody else at work, and because I worked on the floor of the American Stock Exchange, I was an open outcry. I wore a funny jacket, I screamed a lot, and I fought for every trade. My job was to really just murder you and take whatever is left. And I was pretty good at it. And I would scream at somebody, and then like by about 4 o'clock, when the bell would ring, I said, "I got to go talk to Sally. I was really mean to Sally today. I go find Sally before she left the house and left the building." And then I'd start doing stuff like at 2 o'clock. I'd realize I need to go make an amends, you know. And then I started to have this experience with the 10-step where I'd be yelling at somebody and I'd go, "Why don't you just shut up?" Right? And I would actually just shut up and go, "I'm sorry, I was wrong." And people were like, "What?" Okay, they had never heard that. I've been on the floor since 87. They had never heard that from my mouth. I was known as one of the most aggressive people down there. They had never heard me say, "You're sorry?" "Yeah, I'm sorry. I was wrong. Go ahead, do what you got to do." And I go home at night, and I started to realize that, well, maybe this would work at home, too. Right? So she would start to tell me, like, stuff. And I would say, "Dave, don't say a word. Don't say a goddamn word. Just don't say anything. Whatever she says, just remember it. And write down in your head, like, the things that you think are important to say. And then review them later on, and if they make sense, tell her." Right? So, later on, I'd go over the mental 3x5 cards in my head, and the things that I would write down is, you know, these pithy responses like, "Did you think of that yourself?" Right? And that's not going to go over well, and, you know, and "Just like your mother." And that wouldn't go over well. And then "When monkeys fly out of my ass," you know. So those kind of answers never really did well for me in my home life. So when I shut my mouth, I actually found out that my home life got dramatically better. Could you imagine that? I wasn't a part and parcel of running the show at home, and the home life got better. The common ground turns out to be one of spirituality, one of non-involvement, at least for me, and allowing things to just kind of unfold the way they're supposed to unfold. And I took the same attitude with the children. I took the same attitude with my mom. And I started to take the same attitude with everybody, that my mouth didn't need to be going at any given time.
You ever hear the expression, what do you get when you take the alcohol and in some cases the drugs out of a lying, cheating, neurotic, insecure, angry, egotistical, violent maniac? You get a lying, cheating, violent, egotistical maniac, right? And you know, just because you remove the alcohol doesn't mean that I become Saint Michael. And it doesn't mean that automatically, if you remove the alcohol, my family is the Keatons. See, and I, you know, for those I know, it could be a dated term, but for me, and it's all over my inventory, you know, I'm pissed off at mom, I'm pissed off at dad, and I'm pissed off at brother, because we are not the Keatons. Right, I don't know if anybody's watched that show, Family Ties, right? Family Ties, right? One guy's, you know, conservative, the parents are liberal, you know, this one's a hippie, she's dating a biker, right? The guy across the street's a nerd, and, you know, whatever's happening, you know, mom and dad are always kissing, everyone's always forgiving everybody, you know, no matter what kind of scrape somebody's in, they're all getting together at the end of the show, pulling for one another, despite how who messes up what, right? And I'm thinking that once we remove alcohol, mom and dad are Elise and, I don't know, Keaton, right? Mr. and Mrs. Keaton, right? And that my brother all of a sudden is Mallory, and I got all these cool people coming over. It's like all of a sudden thinking that I'm entering into the Cleavers, right? And it's a wonderful life. But the truth of the matter is that anybody who dates me successfully or unsuccessfully for 5 years of punching holes in walls and yelling and screaming and calling them names and domestic situations and police reports and scenes around the, you know, in front of the little boy, right? Anybody who dates somebody like me like that for 5 years successfully, something's wrong with them too. Right, because most normal people are walking away from something like that. Someone who hasn't been sickened spiritually, someone who isn't dead inside, knows this ain't right. This guy's a lunatic. I'm walking away from him. Forget about how much alcohol he drinks. He's just a jerk. Right? Anyone who's sticking around with a situation for a guy like me anyway, or in the ways that I behaved and the hell that I put you up, there's something wrong with you too. You know? So I don't, you know, just because we take alcohol out of my body, and just because we take alcohol out of my family in that respect too, doesn't mean I'm instantly in some sort of Leave It to Beaver land and everybody's getting along great, right? And they talk about the whole family needing, and I love this word, deflation. It involves a process of deflation, and I'm going to not find it, but I don't know where it is in the original manuscript or how it fits, but it's one of the part of the six-step process that these guys were a part of before it became a 12-step process. And one of the first ones was called ego deflation, right? And it's kind of 1, 2, and 3, admitting that I'm powerless and realizing that I need help and that I need something else to come in here. And it's telling me, and it's telling my mother, it's telling my father, it's telling my girlfriend, it's telling my children, it's telling my neighbors, it's telling my employers, it's telling everybody who's around me, we all kind of need an ego deflation process because we've been all trying to fight this war of alcoholism. We've been all, and you know, maybe they have alcoholism, maybe they have alcoholic tendencies, maybe it runs in their family, right? But you know, that's why they have these groups, ACOA, right? Adult Children of Alcoholics. That's why they have Al-Anon and these other groups. You know, in the beginning, you know, the first days of AA, the husband or the wife, whoever the alcoholic was, who may be downstairs getting a meeting, talking about, you know, their inventory process and talking what it was like to go through the steps. But the husband and wives, you know, the family members, they went through the step process as well. And the family recovered together. The entire family needs this deflation process. Now, the good news for my family is that I'm not in charge of that deflation process. I don't now get to go around and start saying, hey, mom, you got an ego problem. You need to start chilling out, right? You know, you've got a problem with patience. You've got a problem with your mouth. You need to chill out. You need to slow it down. Stop treating daddy like this. Stop treating me like this, right? The ego deflation doesn't come from me. That comes from God. That comes from somebody else, right? And the truth is, yeah, everyone's always looking for what life is going to be like when Michael gets back together again. Well, the horrible truth of the matter is Michael has no idea what life is going to be like when Michael gets back together again, because Michael never knew who he was in the first place. And chances are, just because I remove the alcohol doesn't mean that I all of a sudden am a good boy and that I'm all of a sudden a gentleman. I need a lot of help. And so that we all together have to have this process of, you know, deflation and tolerance, right? Respect, understanding. And they say here again, we find one more member of the family demands that the other concede to him, the more the resentful they become, right? Concede. It means to submit under pressure. Right? It tells me exactly what the family is looking like with or without a drink. Pressure, 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 pressure. Fighting, right? My sex life is supposed to be like this. My money life is supposed to be like this. You're supposed to treat me this way and everything else. It's a little bit of a third step exercise. It's a little bit of page 52 going on around here, right? Page 52, right? They call it the bedevilments. You know, am I full of fear? Do I have anger? Am I having problems with my personal relationships? You know, fears of financial insecurity. Am I a prey to misery? Am I a prey to depression? Right? Am I still trying to run the show here? Or am I allowing the possibility of God to do this thing? And so it's kind of interesting that they're addressing that, hey, listen, you know, Finley's sick, but guess what? So are you. You know? And we all need some help here.
Yeah. Back to me?
Unless you want me to read, but I don't have the book. Okay. We're on page 56 of the family afterward.
The Latin edition?
And why? Is it not because he wants to play the lead? Is it not because each is trying to arrange the family show to his liking? Is he not consciously trying to seek what he can take out of the family life rather than to give? It's just the same thing. Just replace actor, right? They talk about it on page 63. Cessation of drinking is but the first step away from a highly strained, abnormal condition. A doctor said the other day, years of living with an alcoholic is almost as sure to make any wife or child neurotic. The entire family is, to some extent, ill, right? And that's the truth of the matter, right? Let families realize as they start their journey that that all will not be fair weather. Each in his turn will be a footsore and will straggle. There will be alluring shortcuts and bypaths down which they may wander and lose their way. So again, it's this idea of let me take a look at where I am right now. In this process, the elimination of alcohol is just a beginning, right? And it says it's the first, step away from a highly strained, abnormal condition, highly strained, abnormal family, highly strained, abnormal relationships, highly strained, abnormal behaviors. Even the doctors. Right, are saying years of alcoholic life means everybody's sick. Everyone's got to recover. Everyone probably could use some therapy. Everybody could use a little God. Everybody could possibly use some other ways of looking at things. But all the time, you know, it's a message to the family afterward, but it's also a message to Michael afterward. Where am I now? Right? Where am I now with this? You know, am I still trying to do these things with my family? I'm 11 years sober today. Just got out of church, right? Took my mom after church voluntarily because I'm a nice guy to drive around to look at houses because my mom has to sell. And I guess my mom wanted to talk to somebody in this neighborhood to kind of ask about what it was going. And I just kind of kept driving by. And was first thing my mother says, "Oh, you're impatient, right? You're impatient." Now, immediately, interiorly, I'm like, who the hell are you to call me impatient? You know what I mean? Like, do you know what the hell, you know what I'm saying? Like, no, you know, no. And if I am impatient, I got that from you, psycho. Right? That's what's going on in the car at the stop site with my mother, 78 years old, who just lost her husband 2 months ago. Right? Here I am wanting to cut down. I'm in the middle of resentment. I'm in the middle of fear. I'm in the middle of these types of things. Right? It's a good question to ask myself. Where am I afterward? How am I doing today? Right? Is my experience at the elimination of alcohol enough for me? Or do I need a hell of a lot more to deal with? Right? And what are those things? Where am I falling short in these areas? Have I written a thorough inventory? Have I held things back on a fifth step that I'm not sharing with a sponsor? Are there unfinished amends that I still, you know, think that I have power over or I don't need to make? Am I praying every day? Am I meditating? Am I working with other alcoholics? You know, where am I today? Where is Michael afterward? It's a good way to check in. It's not my job to fix my mother and my family, right? It's my job to see how I'm going to act in these situations. Now, my mother knew, she could sense that something was off. She could sense that I wasn't feeling too well by her comment. The truth in the past would be, though, she makes a comment, I'm yelling and screaming, we're starting to call each other names. If I'm lucky, I'm driving her home. Maybe I'm walking out and leaving her in the car and running to the bar. I mean, that's the way it was in the past, right? I'm calling her a bunch of names. As soon as she hits a certain volume or pitch in her voice, I'm out the door. Thankfully, you know, there was some quiet. Thankfully, there was a little bit of God help me, God help me, God help me. You know what, God, let's just go home. And then when we got home, she started up a little bit again, but I just started saying, Ma, where's that paperwork you needed help filling out? After we finished out paperwork, you mentioned some other paperwork. What else can we do here? Right? It was the best I could do. I wish I could tell you at that particular moment that I was Bill and Elise Keaton or whatever the story, or that I was Ward Cleaver, but I wasn't, you know. But I did go to, I did understand who I am in this story, and in this story I'm the created being and I need help and I needed to go to God. And so I just kept saying, God help me, God help me, God give me words, God help me.
So, you know, it's an interesting evolution that has occurred in my family after getting sober in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, after doing step work and getting with God and doing all the things that I thought I didn't need to do the first time I came around, is that I start to see people differently, right? I started to see my mother differently. I started to see my wife and then my ex-wife differently. I started to see my current wife differently. But I started to have an empathy for their needs, right? Their desires and their perspective that I never had before. You know, I started to see my mother for who she truly was. And for many, many years, when I thought of my mother, I had her on a pedestal, right? I mean, here was a woman who I had this kind of vision of, that she was this particular person, that she could do no wrong in my mind. She had saved my life. She was highly intelligent. She made no mistakes, and just, you know, right down the line, all the things that I would attribute to her. You know, literally, and I would say to the kids as they grew up, "We got to go to Grammy's house. We got to go to Grammy's house. We got to go to Grammy's house. You got to honor your grandmother, you know, while she's still alive. She's the only one of the four, right?" And over the years, things started to happen, and I started to see my mother as a human being. Now imagine that. As a human being, I started to understand that she had desires and wants and things and preconceived notions about how I should act. She was still telling me how to raise the kids, you know, when they were like going to college, right? She was still telling me how to run my life like a mother would, right? When I was turning 50. Right, there was all these things that were going on that in the past I would have taken offense to. Mm-hmm. I'm 60. Shut up. You know, I'm successful. Mm-hmm. Right, and then I started to realize this is her connection to me as being a mom. This is her connection to me, like having watched me grow up and had survived, you know, being kidnapped by Colombians and all the other things I had survived. And I started to recognize her for who she truly was. And it was in this layer of empathy that I began to have for my mother. Right, I would never have had unless a guy like Dr. Bob had said, and boiled down to last, it's all about love, and we all know what love is, and it's all about service, we all know what service is. Right? This is a guy, after 15 years of being the second longest alcoholic, gave a talk in 1950 at the first international convention, dying of cancer, gave a talk for 3.5 minutes, and literally said, this whole thing is about love and service. But he didn't say this whole thing is about love and service to just the alcoholic, or just the alcoholic who needs you, right? Or just the alcoholic that makes you look good, right? Or just the alcoholic who's fun to hang out with. It's about being of love and service to every single person that's out there, especially the ones that I don't like, right? Not that I didn't like my mom. I love my mom. I learned to love my father in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. My father, I came home one day in the mid-ish 90s to a letter on the floor because we had a mail slot in the door, and the dog used to chew the mail, right? So the corner of this envelope was gone. But this is from the Social Security Administration. It was a death check for my father. That's how I found out that my father had died. He had been murdered in Dade County Jail. And we had no idea where he had been the last couple of years. He had just disappeared. He suffered from issues outside of these rooms. And, I investigated what had happened. You know, I talked to the detective down in Miami. And, you know, I tried to have his remains moved to a plot up here in New Jersey. And because he was buried in a pauper's field, They were real reluctant to try and send his remains up, which I would find out later when I, after years of trying to get this done, I actually hired a mortuary to do the process, right? To go forward with the process, even though Miami wasn't being very helpful. And he came back to me and said, "Dave, we're never going to get your father because they don't really know where he is, you know?" So, you know, I wanted to make amends to my father for a variety of things, but I also wanted to get right with my father, you know. And it was only through prayer and meditation to understand that, you know, my father did absolutely the best job he could. He did the absolute best job he could with the tools that God gave him, right? Imagine that. He actually tried, right? And every day that I wake up, I try to be a father to my kids, and I try to be a husband to my wife, and I try to be an ex-husband to my ex-wife, and I try to be, you know, a son to my mom, you know. But, like Mike so aptly described it, we are beholden to the things we have not gotten rid of yet in this process, right? I would love to have wandered in these rooms and gotten a coffee commitment and been okay, right? Now, coffee commitment was perfect when I got it because I threw extra Bustelo in your coffee and you'd be up until like 4 in the morning going, boy, that was strong coffee, right? And I'd be home asleep because I knew not to drink the coffee. And, you know, coffee commitment got far enough to take another service commitment, which got me far enough to stay around just long enough to eventually find out that I actually had to do the steps. But I don't want to be beholden to the things that brought me to my knees. And it wasn't drugs and alcohol that brought me to my knees, right? It was what went on between my ears that brought me to my knees, right? I had burned every bridge. Everyone was gone in the end, right? You don't burn every bridge unless you've done shit that pisses them off. And who did I piss off? Everybody, including my mom, you know? I was a very selfish person up until yesterday. I really was. It was horrible. And coming into the, you know, these rooms and then coming into the family afterward, that doesn't go away overnight. And the common ground has to be that we want to get better together as a family. You know, ultimately with my ex-wife, we realized we did not want to be together. Her and I did not want us to be together. And the kids were actually happy that we weren't together. There was no outward fights, right? But there was no outward love. Right? Completely different story now with my current wife, right? There's outward love. The children see this. And, you know, this idea that we should be on common ground requires us to be in the right place at the right time with the right people, right? Sometimes the best things that I can do is let you go as opposed to hold you hostage. You know, I think I said this last week. My first wife and I met, you know, in Narcotics Anonymous, and our first date, you know, within 3 months, we were living together. You know, it's like every NA date should come with a U-Haul. You know, it's just, that's the way it was. And we stayed married for 23 years, and we probably stayed married for probably 15 years beyond what we should have. Right? Stubbornness on my part was part of it, because I didn't want to be my dad. Right? Knowing these things comes out of inventory. Knowing these things comes out of writing about what am I afraid of? What am I trying to hide? Because it shows up in a resentment, right? My fear inventories have been great, I will very quickly get mad before tell you I'm afraid. So it's the resentment that's going to lead me to this idea of where I'm actually broken with you and God as well as myself. Because there's only three places I can be broken, right? You, me, or God. That's it, right? And the big one's God. The big one's God. Because that guy is the one that can't fight back. Can't argue with me. I can just be mad at God when I want to, when it's convenient, right? When shit's not working out my way, right? You, if I attack you verbally, you might actually have a response that deflates my delusion. Best not to do that, right? So the big one is God, the one I'm never going to get over. Sometimes, suppose we tell you some of the obstacles a family will meet. Suppose we suggest how they may be avoided, even converted to good use for others. The family of an alcoholic longs for the return of happiness and security. They remember when father was romantic, thoughtful, and successful. Today, life is measured against that of others' years. And when it falls short, the family may be unhappy. I never, at the absolute peak of my alcoholism, right, but not my drinking career. The absolute peak of my alcoholism, I was making a ridiculous amount of money. Ridiculous. And not a single family member wanted to be with me. Because it took all that energy of alcoholism to throw myself into 80 to 100 hour weeks. I had to be willing to abandon everything that I would have told you 5 years earlier was the most important thing in my life. My wife and my children. Right? So in my case, it wasn't the return to the happy years. Right? Prosperity was never the happiness. And I've never sought that since coming back to these rooms. I have found that for me, that the pursuit of money is one of the things that ties me to the delusion. Family confidence in dad is rising high. The good old days will soon be back, they think. Sometimes they demand that dad bring them back instantly. God, they believe, almost owes this recompense on a long overdue account. But the head of the house has spent years in pulling down the structures of business, romance, friendship, health. These things are now ruined or damaged. It will take time to clear away the wreck. The old buildings will eventually be replaced by finer ones. The new structures will take years to complete. You know, one of the interesting things that I know about my alcoholism and ego, if you guys have ever spent real time with pen and paper looking at the inventory process and resentments, the idea of what has actually taken, you know, cut you out at the knees, for me, it was ego. I made the worst decision I ever made, which was buy another firm, at the peak of my alcoholism, which was the summer of 2001, I closed that deal, right? Wiped my company out, ultimately, because of the market crash and ensued after the terrorist attacks, the whole nine yards. And I did it all out of ego, right? I wanted to be a big firm, right? I wanted to have a lot of employees. Got to 100 employees, right? Two countries, seven offices, right? $625,000 a month to open the doors, right? And the moment I signed that paper, we stopped making money. Right? God has an interesting way of relieving us of that which ails us, right? And I'll never forget hitting my knees in 2004 after coming back, no, 2005 and coming back in these rooms and saying to God, I said, God, if you want me to be bankrupt, I'm in the game. I'm in the game. Right? And the funny thing was, it never got worse after that moment. I have always found that when I'm in the darkest hour, when I'm willing to actually turn this shit over, it gets turned over. Who knew? Right? Who knew? That actual honest desire to get with God and let God run the show would result in a level of peace and contentment and serenity and understanding of those around me. The finer structures that have been built in my life today are the people in this room, this meeting, the people that I sponsor, my wife, my children, my daughter who's on the way, right? All of this, right? The people I've met here, the finer structures. Right? They cost no money. Right? They're all a gift. Right? I've never won for anything from that moment when I hit my knees in 2005 till today. That doesn't mean that I've ever had anything like what I used to have, and I don't ever want it. Right? I would give it away faster than I could get it. Because money has always brought me problems. Always. It's always driven the worst part of me. Father knows he is to blame. It may take him seasons of hard work to be restored financially, but he shouldn't be reproached. Perhaps he will never have money again, never have much money again, but the wise family will admire him for what he is trying to be rather than for what he is trying to get.
Right. So, it's that question, I am what I worship, right? I am what I worship, you know? Am I trying to regain status? Am I trying to regain money? Am I trying to become popular in AA? Am I trying to, have sexual relations? You know, what is it am I looking to get? And what is it am I looking to be? Right? If my family sees me trying to be a better man, if my family sees me trying to be a gentleman, which is why I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, that's the code word. I really wish I could tell you that I came here to stop drinking. That's not the truth. I came here to be a gentleman because I could not stand the man in the mirror. I wanted to kill him. I wished him dead, and I tried to kill him. I tried to kill him by using alcohol and other things. I tried to kill him by using pills and an attempted overdose. And I was the type of guy who would take salt on the salt shakers and pull them off and swallow the salt, or I would put extra salt all over my things because I knew eventually I'd get high blood pressure and die. Right? And I smoked more cigarettes. Like if I smoked one pack, I smoked two packs. Like I knew eventually the product says, you know, this will cause death and cancer and all this other stuff, and I'm like, yeah, I want that because I want out of life. I want out of these feelings. I want out of these emotions. I want them out of the truth of the man in the mirror. I wasn't a very good boyfriend. to say the least. I wasn't a very good son. My father had a clean name. You know, Finley, before I got it, was a clean name. Right? I took that name and I tore it around in all of the police blotters around town. I dragged that name into, you know, New York City clubs. I took it into the dungeons. I took it into the sewer. You know, I took my father's good name and I destroyed that name. Right? That's what, that's the guy who looked in the mirror. You know, a guy who was completely dirty and filthy spiritually, mentally, and I was busted up physically too. I did not come here because I wanted to stop drinking. In all honesty, I wanted to be a gentleman. I wanted to be a better man. I wanted to be a son. I only wished that I could be one of the Cleaver's kids, you know. And so if my family sees me trying to be a gentleman, if my family sees me trying to be a better man, if my family sees me trying to be a better son, if my girlfriend or, you know, my wife or husband or whomever sees me trying to be a better husband or boyfriend, chances are, at some point in time, based upon my efforts at trying to be a better one of those things, they may forgive my faults. They may forgive my shortcomings. They may forgive, you know, my inability to take my mom out on a drive to go look at houses, right? Oddly enough, you know, my mother was the type of person that, in sobriety and outside of sobriety, that when I would say to her, "Hey, mom," you know, when I was making amends to my mom after 5 years of being sober, and that's because my mom wasn't ready. She didn't want it. She didn't want me to make those amends. She wasn't ready for that. But when I said, "Mom, when I was 9 years old, I told you I hated you," she was like, "Damn straight you did." You know, my mother remembered that. And any time that I've apologized being sober and in Alcoholics Anonymous, my mother always would say in return, almost often always would say, "That's right, you did do that. You did screw that up. Yeah, you did slam the door. Yeah, you did talk that way to me." Let me tell you something. And it's an amazing thing, you know, is that, and my mom doesn't do this stuff. My mom does not go to Al-Anon or do any of these things. She tries to seek something on her own. You know, whatever she's doing. But in this past year, I say to my mom, "Mom, you know, I owe you an apology. You know, last night I carried on a little bit. I went upstairs. I got closed off. I got distant. I got emotional. I raised my voice a little bit. You know, it's just my own fear and my own insecurity, Mom. I'm sorry." My mom says, "That's okay. We all get like that sometimes." I'm 46 years old. I never heard my mother say that until I was 46 years old. You know, maybe some way, shape, or form by me, you know, trying to be a better man, trying to be a better son, trying to be a better gentleman. Now all of a sudden I have a mother who also apologizes or asks for forgiveness, something that I haven't experienced my whole life. You know, and my father, who did pass away 2 months ago, he saw a son that gave that name dignity. He saw a son that made that name proud. And my family got to see, you know, the miracles that Alcoholics Anonymous witnesses by seeing a funeral parlor filled with sober alcoholics cheering and smiling and coming around and comforting me. People that had been changed as a result of these steps. People that had had a spiritual experience and spiritual awakening. People that were trying to be something else. Not just remove a drink. Not just remove a drug. Not just remove food or any of these other things. People that were trying to be better men, better women, better people, better children, better husbands. And so, it says in this next paragraph, it talks about how, I'll read it. "Father knows he is to blame." We did that one? Right. We did that one. So now and then the family will be plagued by specters from the past, for the drinking career of almost every alcoholic has been marked by escapades, funny, humiliating, shameful, or tragic. Quick question. Has your drinking career been filled by marks of escapades, funny and humiliating, shameful and tragic? The first impulse would be to bury these skeletons in a dark closet and padlock the door. Let me ask you, is that what you're trying to do? Are you trying to bury the skeletons in a dark closet and padlock the door? Am I still trying to do that? That's not the promises that this book makes for me. It tells me I will not regret the past and I will not want to shut the door on it. And so, you know, 10 plus years sober, a guy who totally destroys and ruins his father's name, a guy who's totally embarrassed and ashamed to walk into the room with his father for what he has done to both him, his name, and maybe even, you know, the family house and the family finances and everything else, and all the Christmases I destroyed, and all the Easters that I didn't show up for, and all of the Thanksgivings that I was like loaded, or having domestic situations either in the driveway, in the backyard, upstairs in the back room, and all these other kind of scenarios that my family had to witness. They didn't get to. They had to witness or deal with these situations. You know, what my dad winds up getting is a guy who does not wish to regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. I thank God the day he made me an alcoholic. It's one of the greatest things that had ever happened in my life. Not because of the horrible things that I had done, because the day that I realized that I was truly powerless over alcohol, I also realized that I was powerless over all of my defects of character. I was powerless over lust. I was powerless over anger. I was powerless over fear. I was powerless over my delusional thinking. I was powerless over my intolerance. I was powerless over impatience. And the day that I realized that and came to the truth of that understanding, that I am the real deal alcoholic and I'm going to drink no matter what, God enters my life. And so I thank God for the day he made me an alcoholic and for the realization that I am a real deal alcoholic. Because if it wasn't for that truth, I wouldn't seek God, want God, or need God like I do today. Even today, with 11 years sober, driving around with his mom, I need God more than I probably did 11 years ago. Because there's still times where I can't handle a 5-minute car ride without getting a little uncomfortable. I realize now more than ever that I need God. But the truth of the matter is that I do not wish to shut the door, nor regret it at all. And it's a question is if I am still feeling this way, if I'm still feeling the humiliation, if I'm still reliving the shame, if I'm still reliving the tragedy, if I'm still caught up and trying to bury the skeletons in the closet and sweep them under the rug and hope my family just forgets all of those Christmases and just all of a sudden like pretends it didn't happen. If I'm that guy, then chances are I'm not having the experience that this book promises me. This book promises me that this will no longer be an issue for me. That I'm going to be alive and awakened spirit, walking hand in hand with the Creator. That my life will be recreated as a result of this process. And if that is true for me today, then the man who buried his father 2 months ago is a man with no regrets. I sat and I watched that guy die before my eyes. And I did not regret a second. I didn't say, oh, I wish I should have said this, or I wish I could have done this. Not once. Not once. Not even on the drive from work to his hospital bed. Not once. I didn't even speed, because I knew he wouldn't want me to. I drove down there. I prayed in my father's ears for 2 hours, 3 hours, until his spirit left. And then I got on my knees, not and cried. I didn't weep. I didn't cry for myself. I said, thank you, God, for giving me this experience to be a part of one of the most sacred experiences a person can be a part of, is watching somebody's soul or breathe their last breath. The possibility of whatever comes on next for that person, that I get to be there at that moment. Not, oh my gosh, I wish I had another year to fix up this problem or fix up that problem. No, my dad saw me trying to be a gentleman, being a gentleman, failing at being a gentleman, and getting up the next day and being a gentleman again. My dad saw me apologize. My dad saw me make amends. My dad saw me show up every single week, almost for every 10 years. I showed up at his house and in some way, shape, or form had dinner or had friendly conversation, if it be something about the Yankees or something more serious going on with the family. And I did not regret that one bit, nor when all of the circus came to town to come say their condolences or any of this other stuff, did I wish to duck anybody in my family. I stood like a man, shook every hand, and I had no regrets with anybody else shaking my hand. I was clean and clear as the result of the promise of this work. Praise God. The family may be possessed by the idea that the future happiness can be based only on forgetfulness of the past. Well, isn't that ridiculous? You know, do I all of a sudden want my girlfriend to expect my girlfriend to forget all of the holes in the wall? All of the cracks in the ceiling? All of the names that I called them? Or are they going to be more interested in me being a gentleman? We think that such a view is self-centered and in direct conflict with the new way of living. And again, it's not talking about removal of alcohol. It's not talking about removal of substance. It's talking about a way of life that I must start from the moment I walk in these rooms. I must start a new way of living, a new way of thinking, a new way of sometimes even breathing.
Your family was in the circus?
Oh, of course. Wait till you see them.
Henry Ford once made a wise remark to the effect that experience is the thing of supreme value in life. Now, I have to tell you something. I ran around Alcoholics Anonymous like a madman. When I first came back in 2004, I made a promise to myself I'd go to a new meeting every time I left the house here in Jersey. I had my home group, which is at lunchtime in Manhattan, but whenever I was in Jersey, I was going to take out the meeting book and go to a new meeting and just check it all out, right? I was going to be like a total newcomer. And then, after a while, I fell in with a group not too far from here, and I've had the experience of being a meeting makers make it kind of guy, right? I've been a service junkie, right? I've been running around like a crazy man and go to every meeting you possibly can guy. I've been a strong sponsorship guy. I've been a love to hear myself speak guy, you know, and then threw myself into Big Book. But the one thing that really changed my perception of you guys and God and then ultimately myself was this thing that they just said right here. Experience is the thing of supreme value in life. Mm-hmm. My sponsor, Chris, who you've had the pleasure of seeing me present with for several weeks now, he says, I do experiential Big Book work. You can't have my experience. And ultimately, I came to realize I don't want anybody else's experience. No matter how flawed I may have previously judged my experience, it's been perfect for me. Because how could it not be perfect if it occurred in God's world, right? And that also applies to the experience I have of being a father, of being a son, of being a husband, of being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, of being your friend, right? Of working with you, of talking to you, right? It's all a matter of learning. I have to unlearn the things that brought me here in order to become that which I truly am. That is true if one is willing to turn the past to good account. We go by our willingness to face and rectify errors and convert them into assets. The alcoholic's past thus becomes the principal asset of the family, and frequently it is the only one. The painful past may be of infinite value to other families still struggling with their problem. We think each family which has been relieved owes something to those which have not. And when the occasion requires, each member of it who has found God should be only too willing to bring former mistakes, no matter how grievous, out of their hiding places. Showing others who suffer how we are given victory is the very thing which makes life seem so worthwhile to us now. Cling to the thought that, in God's hands, the dark past is the greatest possession you have, the key to life and happiness for others. With it, you can avert death and misery for them. Now, for those of you who've had the great grace of sitting with another alcoholic and giving your fifth step or hearing their fifth step, right, you will know that if you share the deepest, darkest secrets that you would have made a commit. Have you ever made a commitment to yourself? I am never going to tell anybody that. Right? I'm not talking about that. You know, when you wake up next to the 6 foot two. Well, anyway, no, that's not the important thing. I'm not going to talk about that. I'm going to the grave with that. You know, when I was 90 days sober in 1985, a guy I used to hang out with and I had ran into each other in a meeting. And to celebrate the 90 days, I shot some heroin. And I went back the next day, raised my hand, said I have 91 days. Didn't talk about it for 17 years. Right? Never told anybody. He died with that secret, never having told anybody. And I only told it because when I came back to these rooms in 2004 that I had, I've been talking about it for 19 years, came back, I was going to do everything you said because it wasn't going to work for me. Right? The secrets that I bring to the grave with me are the things that will make the grave come a lot faster. Mm. Right? But it's that idea that I can learn to have faith in God that I can share with you my deepest, darkest secrets. Right? The stuff that I was never going to tell anybody, the secrets that really kind of like make me feel shameful about myself. Right? The things that I carry around, like the dead carcass of a deer off of Route 22. Let me just drag this behind me my entire life. See how that works out. Right? And then I find out that you've got two deer with you. And we talk about the deer. And all of a sudden the deer disappear. Right? And I go back out into the word relieved. Right? And then I meet the next guy who I hear his fist up and he tells me about a different deer. And that reminds me of a deer that I had. And I tell him about the deer. Right? And he goes, yeah, you did that too? Right? Now, I haven't had everybody's deer, and not everybody's had my deer. But we got a whole slew of deer in this room, and I got to tell you something. I don't. What do they call it? A flock of deer?
A herd.
Thank you. Yeah, don't put it on me.
There's a herd of deer in our stories. Mm-hmm. And they're no longer shameful when we suddenly realize that we're all bound by this commonality. We got dead deer. Is it a herd?
Yeah, it's a herd.
Thank you for looking it up. So a group of ladybugs is called a beautiful. And a group of crows is called a murder. Ravens, thank you. So what do they call the pronouns? Anyway, moving right along. What do they call the alcoholics? The anonymi? You know, this idea that the things that I have in me that I'll never tell you, and that first time that I ever told somebody about that worst thing that I ever did, it felt so good I went out and told a bunch of other people.
Right.
And then a friend of mine goes, Shane, you probably don't want to run around telling that. I go, that's good information. So you got anything else?
Just to, I guess, restate what you're saying so well, is that in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, am I that guy that Dave is talking about? Am I talking about my past in a way that is for good? Or am I sitting around talking about my past to prove to you that I'm a real alcoholic or that I drank more than you or that my scrapes are a good scrape and that you should really be impressed with, you know, all the places that alcohol or booze has taken me? Or am I telling you about the stories of my past to show you and bear witness, as the original manuscript says, victory. In the book here that gets printed, it says, we were given help over the very thing. He says victory in the original manuscript. You know, so am I bearing witness to the victory over these things, the victory over the fear, the victory over the guilt, the victory over the shame, over the anger, over the violence, over the delusional thinking? Am I showing and bearing witness to that by using my past? Or am I using my past to try to, you know, gain fame in these rooms, and I'm failing to show and bear witness to the victory, which is what the third step is all about, right? By doing this work, I get to have victory over these things. If I don't have victory over these things, then I cannot be of help to others. And it may be best to consider the possibility of maybe sharing less about those past occurrences until I have those victories. But they're most helpful if I can show you the victory.
So I think that's about it. We're going to open it up.